Good evening. I don't know if, how's that volume? I can't really tell.
That's good.
Okay. Sounds to me like I'm a little bit of an echo chamber, but. Okay, good. So, someone recently asked me question. They asked me why I sometimes refer to what we're doing here or our practice here as religion. And kind of the tone that they asked me this question in, I had a feeling that they wished that I didn't use this word. And I didn't refer maybe to what we're doing here as religion. Some people have been kind of traumatized. Not kind of, they have been traumatized by association with religion in the past. And I think also there might be a feeling that religion implies a kind of dogmatic approach to or to spiritual life. You know, we're trying to when we have religion, we're trying to get you to believe such and such. So just to be clear, it's never been my intent here to traumatize anyone or re-traumatize anyone. The word today is trigger anyone about their past experiences. Nor is it my intent to, have you accept something, some belief that doesn't accord with your experience. What my usual intent when I talk here is to increase your enthusiasm for practice, to give you more motivation to practice. So if I use some term like religion that diminishes your enthusiasm, then it's good that you tell me that. And, you know, I can consider that, or I can also say, I can use a different word like spiritual life. Another reason that a person maybe doesn't respond to the word religion is like their feeling that, you know, what we're doing here is engaging with the living moment. We're engaging with living moment, and religion sounds like something that's dead, or it's already, you know, it's codified. Yeah. Here's the codified thing. Here's our package. Accept this package and
your place in it.
And your place in it, exactly. So we don't want to give that I don't want to give that impression what we're doing here. I personally have had some experience in my life that has in which what I can only describe as religious feeling has welled up in me, that's just one word for it. That's just a word. So and hopefully, you know, we've all had some experience through practice where some, you know, strong feeling wells up in us that we are, you know, going down the right path, and that we are the practice is confirming our life, confirming itself. It's the self-receiving and employing samadhi, right? It's the samadhi that justifies and confirms itself. And so when we engage in that samadhi, it feels true and real and not something prepackaged. So I'm glad this was brought up. If I use the word religion, I'm not talking about that, you know, prepackaged set of beliefs or something that you're required to adhere to or accept. So this is all the way by the way of introducing this topic, the record of transmitting the light, because it's hard to really say that this is not a religious document. It's actually sort of emblematic of what religions do. And what religions do is what all religions do, like to do, is tell and retell and retell again and retell again the stories about their founder, about the person that was at the inception of this, of their practice. And they like to tell that story, and they like to tell the story about the disciples of that person, and so on, and the disciples of that person. And so, you know, that is something I believe that defines what a religion is. A religion isn't something as we commonly understand it, that just popped up in modern times. It all of the known, you know, established religions look back. They look back, most all of them, centuries, and they enjoy studying and learning about those people that have kept their tradition alive and made it possible that it would come up to this day and still be a living tradition. And so that's what this book, Transmission of the Light, is about. It's a record created in the 13th century by a Japanese Zen master who was the third after Dogen. So the third who received the transmission of the Soto Zen lineage in Japan from Dogen. And what he did was there were already well-known Chinese records of the transmission through many generations of Zen teachers. And what he did is he looked back on those records, and he re-described that lineage and that succession of ancestors that began with the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. So he looked back on that, and he in this work, he tells one simple story, usually about that person and how it was that they became an awake human being, an enlightened person. And then he gives some background on them, and then he gives a talk, a lecture based on that their enlightenment and their life, and he just goes on from there. So he is doing something again that religious teachers have done throughout the ages, which is continually reinterpreting and re-envisioning who these people were that started, and this is happening today, right? We're still reimagining who Christ was, who Muhammad was, who Buddha was. And some of those imaginations are, actually quite strange, but be that as it may, and Buddhism isn't necessarily exempt from having strange imaginations about that lineage either. So that's what the nature of this book is, and we decided in the Valley Streams study group a month ago or something, 2 months ago, we decided to start reading the cases in this. Of each, there's 53 masters discussed in this book, and we decided to start at Shakyamuni and keep going. And now we're skipping a few. We're trying to move on from the Indian ancestors. There's like 28 Indian ancestors, so we're trying to get out of the Indian ancestors, and maybe eventually will we start talking about the. About the Chinese Zen ancestors, and then at the end there's just a few Japanese Zen masters that are discussed in the book. So one of the things you can do, we announced like last week that this is our study period. So one of the possibilities you can undertake is if you can't come to the study group, which most people can't come because it's at 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning, you can follow along with the readings we're doing, and if you send an email to info@valleystreams.org, we can put you on the auditors list, and some people are doing that. They're reading along with us, even though they're not participating in the discussions. And some of us have been writing poems based on the cases in the book. So there'll be a few chances throughout the study period to talk about the lineage holders, and like I am tonight, but the study group will kind of keep running. We like to get together, and they're very short chapters, so we read the whole thing together, and then we discuss it. And we're also reading. For more people who want to get into the weeds, we're reading a commentary or another. We're reading two translations, one of which is a new one that's been done by the Soto Shu, which is the hierarchy of Zen. That two scholars have done a new translation and with commentary, and some of us are reading that in addition online. And so that's the study topic that we're looking at. So what is, this talk, this says the record of transmitting the light. So I wanted to ask you, what is the light? And I'm not asking you, but I'm going to tell you what the dogma is. Now, the light is probably fairly obvious. It's the awakened mind, right? It's the living tradition of the teaching, embodied and minded in the awakened mind that has been passed from generation to generation. And light is a great image itself, because light has this quality of going equally in every direction and illuminating everything in its path. But, of course, you only see the illuminations, you don't see the light. So it has a nice reference to a kind of melding or merging of form and emptiness. Light kind of references that. And there are other metaphors that are used for when speaking about what this transmitted light is like. There's many metaphors that are used because that transmitted light is also identical or identified with, as I was saying, the awakened self, the true self, the Buddha mind, the Buddha mind seal. There's a lot of synonyms that are and metaphors that are used throughout this, which is a very literary work. The person who wrote this was a poet, and he was very knowledgeable and he was brilliant, and so he Norman Fisher's topic is going to be what is it? Imagination. Well, you know, imagination in the path. Well, this is an example of, you know, Buddhist imagination. Starting off with these, you know, well-known stories, but then, you know, elaborating and commenting on them in very creative and poetic ways. So it's kind of a mytho-poetic transmission. And so some of the metaphors that are used are like, a pearl, a bright round pearl that cannot be made any more lustrous by polishing. So this is a very wonderful, kind of metaphor for the inner light or the true self that's in that we can't be separate from. One lustrous pearl that can't be made any more lustrous by any willful act on our part, but which can be, you know, appreciated and be cultivated, right? Pearls are cultivated. So your pearl can be cultivated. So there's other metaphors like it's an object so beautiful no painter can capture it. You know, no human being could actually render it in a painting.
Sound at the bottom of the stream.
A sound at the bottom of the stream, exactly. It's likened to the wind that circulates everywhere and shakes the whole world, but can't be seen. So that's another nice metaphor. So there's in the first story in the book. The first story, as you might guess, is the story of Shakyamuni Buddha, the founder of the tradition. And it says, I will just read you this little part about Shakyamuni Buddha. It says, this is Keizan, this is the author's presentation in translation. Shakyamuni Buddha practiced austerities for 6 years. Then it says, later, he sat on the adamantine seat where spiders spun webs in his eyebrows and magpies built a nest on top of his head. Reeds grew up between his legs as he sat tranquilly and erect for 6 years. At the age of 30, on the eighth day of the 12th month, as the morning star appeared, he was suddenly enlightened. Then he said, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. So I would submit that this is the kind of stories that religions tell. Religions tell these kinds of stories. You have a question? Yeah, probably.
Can you say that again?
Was the star Venus?
Like when they say the morning star is that Venus?
Yeah.
We understand it to be that.
Yeah, Venus. We kind of think that's probably the star, Venus. So what this story has a certain fantastic aspect, right? All of the stories about the Indian ancestors particularly have rather fantastic aspects to them. So we're invited to imagine that this founder of our tradition sat for 6 years. According to Kazon, which is a little different presentation, he practiced austerities for 6 years, and then he sat for another six. The usual way you hear this is that it was his whole pre-enlightenment work was of 6 years. So unclear on exactly what that was, but. Magpies built a nest on top of his head while he was doing this, and reeds grew up between his legs. So it's a fantastic story, and it's a story that has a moral, right? This is another thing that religions do. They tell stories that have a moral. And the moral of the story is sit still, don't be disturbed by magpies making a nest on top of your head. Don't be disturbed by outer phenomena. Don't be disturbed by inner phenomena. And stay in the saddle. Who was talking about that? Myo, right? I think Myo was, where was I? I was in some Dharma talk. Anyway, stay in the saddle. And so this is the moral of the story, right? And then the punchline of the story is also, you know, the basic root teaching of Buddhism, which is dependent co-arising. The root teaching, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. So the story is, you know, the story as we get it is that Buddha was doing this practice alone. That's one of the, because part of the story is that he was practicing with some people, but the people left him because he took some sustenance. He had been starving, and he finally decided, no, I'm going to die, and I'm not going to realize my goal unless I take some sustenance. And the people he was practicing with said, "Ah, you're a failure, you're a loser," and so they left. And so he was practicing on his own. But you can't wake up alone. That's one of the teachings here. You don't wake up alone. You wake up together with the great earth and beings. And so we don't. Do this practice on our own. You've heard this many times, and here it is, right here in the very first story of the record of transmitting the light. The second story in the book is about Mahakashyapa. Mahakashyapa was disciple of the Buddha in the time of the Buddha, practicing with the Buddha. He and Ananda were the leading disciples practicing with the Buddha at the time of Buddha was living. And when Myo and I were in China, we saw a beautiful ancient Buddha, Chinese Buddha, and it was a triad or a trio, and on one side of this ancient Buddha was Mahakashyapa, and on the other side was Ananda, and this This is so. These are the three early figures that are talked about, and who practiced with the Buddha, as it's described in the tradition. So, we probably, many of you know the story of Mahakashapa's awakening. It was the wordless transmission. The Buddha held up a flower, and Mahakashapa, it says in here, cracked a smile. It didn't say he smiled, it says he cracked a smile. I thought that was nice. He cracked a smile. That's like the whole story, and it's quite interesting because of course in that second story, Kazon Kazon goes back in the tradition and he's looking for people, of course, he's looking for stories about the people that are great exemplars of his understanding of practice, right? He's being selective about what he's looking for and what he's talking about, because he's trying to draw and encourage his community that he was practicing with in the 13th century. He's wanting to encourage them to continue their practice and be encouraged by these great examples, but in particular ways. And what he's encouraging in the example of Mahakashapa, in pointing out the transmission by a flower, is that the transmission is not dependent on words. It's not dependent on words, which is in the Zen traditions. Understanding of itself, you know, that's a critical piece of understanding. It's not dependent on words. It is also interesting that as far as we've read, and I haven't read every story in this transmission of the light, but as far as we've read in the book, we haven't come across any other disciples who were enlightened without words. In other words, every other story is, after you get past Mahakashapa, every other story is so-and-so heard, or the master said blah, 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 and then his teacher said blah, 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 and then the master was awakened. You know, but every other story is a story about awakening through words. So that's kind of an interesting, I think, contradiction in this, you know, the idea of, you know, well, it's a separate transmission outside the scriptures, not dependent on words and letters, except when it is. and you know, you can't tell a good story, you know, without words, pretty hard. So naturally, we end up with words.
Yeah, you can. You can describe action.
You can describe action.
Like
that's true.
Tugging a robe.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Tugging a corner of a robe. So, what kind of people were the ancestors in our lineage? On the one hand, you could say they were people not at all like us. And especially as we were reading about the Indian ancestors, we see that they were they were people who were possessed of inborn knowledge, and they needed just a little tiny nudge. They didn't need much of a nudge at all, but they needed a little nudge to wake up. But they were really, you know, when you read the Indian ancestors here, they all have supernatural powers. One was born fully clothed in Buddhist robes, of course. And, you know, another in order to meet his master, he had to defeat a demon who was trying to, you know, get him to not practice. So, you know, in that sense, these, especially these Indian masters, don't seem at all like us. But on the other hand, I think they are all like us, because except with the possible exception of Shakyamuni Buddha, and not really, I would say not with, you know, there's no exceptions really to this in terms of the stories, is that none of the people described were truly enlightened at birth. They weren't fully awakened. They needed to do some practice. They needed to meet someone, and that's a really constant theme through this, is that they needed to meet someone to have an interaction with in order to really fully come into their own, to fully wake up, to see their true nature. These early guys had very thin veils, but they needed somebody to help them see through form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. Somebody had to help them. They had to meet somebody to get through that. Question?
Like in Buddhist mythology, like actual Buddhas who are self-awakened are like super rare in Buddhist cosmology. Most people are arhats, where they're, you know, they had an encounter with the teachings of other Buddhas. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it kind of fits that.
Yeah, well, there's stories and there's stories, but that's the stories that I see here. Is the emphasis is on meeting someone with whom you have a connection and an awakening together. The Buddha just met, in a sense, the cosmos, right? He met the whole cosmos, and he had an interaction with the whole cosmos. But after that, everybody else meets the Buddha, and they meet the Buddha's disciple, and the next, and the next, and the next, and the next. And I think that also, that feeling that comes very much down to us today, is that you encourage you to have a meeting with somebody in this life. Have a meeting with someone. And some of us have had meetings with someone that been very influential and caused us to move in an entirely different direction in our life as a result of that meeting. So I don't think there's too much more to say, except that I had this one image that came to me. Is that the way that the stories, the way the koans are in this story, each one is begins with a case, very brief, and it depicts the moment or the interaction that happened in which this person awakened. And I had this image come to me that it was like, maybe it was because I had a massage today, but that like the interaction was like a chiropractic adjustment. The person, the student, was really, really aligned. I mean, he was or she was already really on the beam, but still, there was a turning word. There was a turning word that a teacher said, and when it was just that was just that slight adjustment. When you go, you don't feel like, well, my back is, you know, out of line when you go to the chiropractor, but then they like the masseuse today, they pressed on my back just a little bit and it went, you know, it just went, and she just was like, and she even went, she went, oh. And so it was just like a little change. So I think this, what this points to is that we're always close to it. We're always close to it, but it only just takes a little bit of movement, a little bit of change in our consciousness. Not a huge, you know, explosive event, but it's a little turn, and we see things anew. And that's the feeling I get in a lot of these stories. Just a little adjustment, and the teacher and the master woke up. But you know, the little that happens usually after the person has, you know, done lots of practice. You know, usually it doesn't happen like in the first meeting. Usually it happens after a while, or maybe it happens after several births or multiple births. And we don't know that. I don't know that, but I like this feeling that it's not some earth-shaking change that takes you from, you know, ordinary sloppy human being to, you know, enlightened person, but that there's some practice that kind of influences you first, and then awakening becomes like easy, or falling off a log, or instantaneous, which is the teaching. That's another teaching of Zen, is that practice is a long, hard slog, but enlightenment is just now. Yes, Clem.
Yes, I wanted to say that the story is only the final moment of the journey. It doesn't say how long it took them to get to that point.
Right.
Sometimes it does, and it's years.
Yeah, sometimes, and you know, there's all kinds of great stories about sometimes they're disciples of another person, or they're leading another sangha, and then they meet a Buddhist, and I was just looking at one today where the fellow was a disciple of not a witch, but something like that. So, you know, he was a disciple of a magician or something like that. He was a disciple of a magician, and he had a lot of magician followers. And then he met a Buddhist teacher, and the Buddhist teacher said, "Give that stuff up, forget it. Just take the precept. Just take refuge with me." And in the story, he says, "You're right. I give it up. I'll take refuge with you." So, you know, all of these things. I mean, I think there's quite a bit of, you know, each story has a bit of a point, like, or of showing us, you know, what not to do as well as what to do. So that from that standpoint, you really see how Kaizen is really trying to show us what is of value in this tradition and what is not. What is not worth paying attention to, and what is worth paying attention to. So from that standpoint, if you follow through a lot of these stories, you start to get a well-rounded picture of the religion. Which, don't be afraid, because I don't have the energy to control you. Well, it's 8:45. You've asked some questions. Do you have any further ones, or shall we head out the door? One more.
I don't have to.
Well, you don't have to, but you could. I'm not.
One thing I find interesting about, you know, these lamp anthologies and koan collections and stuff is, you know, I mean, I think most of us aren't, don't believe that, you know. I'd say as maybe I'm speaking for everyone, but, you know, I don't think we're believers of sudden enlightenment as the end-all, be-all of practice. You know, I think under the Soto approach. And it, but it's really interesting how all these stories are very, you know, there's no story like, you know, he's had 14 years and gradually, you know, he stopped, you know, stressing about what his mother thought about him. I don't know. Yeah. And, but it's interesting how like that, you know, that's from a literary standpoint, you know, that's kind of the core of the, you know, the teachings, but it's not really our practice. You know?
Well, actually, as I was saying to the study group, the teaching of, you know, the Southern school of Zen is that enlightenment is sudden. Practice is gradual, but enlightenment is sudden. That is the teaching of Soto Zen. And so that's why I think it's interesting that all of these stories focus on that, which I think is what you're pointing to, is like, well, this would seem to emphasize that enlightenment is really, you know, and this enlightenment experience is really the point. But when you actually read the lectures, you see that at least in Kazon's mind, that's not the point. The point is just, and it's not to, you know, hang some candy out in front of you either, but he's, you know, invariably in his lectures, he's just encouraging people to practice and not, you know, not take side paths. But he doesn't himself actually emphasize the awakening moment. He emphasizes the awakened life.
Like in his commentary afterwards.
In his lectures after he really emphasized the awakened life. Dorley?
Well, in that book, there's one of the masters is Parsva, and that master was very inspiring for me because he was in the womb for 60 years. And he didn't experience enlightenment until he was 80 years old. Well, 80 years later, which was like 150 or something like that.
Well, so you got to live that long if you're going to be in the womb for 60 years.
Well, right. But I mean, I guess I took that somehow metaphorically, that being in the womb is our practice. It's, you know, our ongoing slow practice that's sort of a gestation period like that.
Mm-hmm. So. Very nice.
I know I've read somewhere, and I read so much of this stuff, I forget. It could have been Dogen or maybe Suzuki. But that practice itself is enlightenment.
That's Dogen.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Practice enlightenment, right.
But
And Suzuki Roshi.
But it is gradual. But, I mean, I've been practicing. I don't feel that horribly enlightened. But,
there's some tension there, I think, actually. Yeah, there's some tension there between that teaching and these stories. And we can live with that tension.
You equate enlightenment with a feeling?
I'm sorry?
You equate enlightenment with a feeling?
Oh, I don't know how to equate it because it seems unlikely to me that I've reached it or I know for sure. Yeah, something tells me I haven't reached it to be able to equate it. But I practice because it seems to work. I mean, you know, the same reason I exercise in the morning, I sit in the morning. You know, it seems to work, and I don't analyze it a whole lot beyond that.
I'm curious too about if there's experiences in the book where they have like awakening experiences and then kind of go back in the slog. And then, you know, like as if nothing ever happened. And then, I don't know, do they talk about that at all?
That's in my book that I'm writing. and that's, I have a lot of stories about that. Awakening and then going back in the slog. I find that that's a pretty common experience. Barry told a story about that when he gave a Way-Seeking Mind talk. And I think it is, I think in practice, in reality, it's a fairly common experience, and or feeling, you know, a feeling about our practice, you know, that it's not a linear process, that we, you know, it's and we can get fooled by the highs, you know, we can get fooled I mean, I've been fooled by the highs in my life. I mean, I've had sickness of emptiness, you know, feeling and or experience, and then, you know, then I come, you know, that's usually my feeling about it, but that doesn't come out actually in this book. I didn't see any stories like that.
Karen Hornfield's book, First the Ecstasy and Then the Laundry, is all about that.
I was just reading someone commenting on the Record of Transmission of Light, and each chapter ends, really, the case ends at the Enlightenment. But it doesn't show what happens after, and the commentary was that the Enlightenment is just the beginning of their practice. There's a lot, you know, that goes on after. So we don't have that in that book.
Right.
Well, it defies description, doesn't it? It's beyond words.
Well, again, and you know, it's almost like the Enlightenment stories in the book are not as important as, you know, ultimately for Kazon, as simply encouragement to keep going in practice. I think that is really his point, is that he gave these originally as lectures to his monks in Daijo Monastery, and so at the end of each Taisho he's always, you know, well, first of all, he'll usually say, you people are far from the way, and then he'll kind of say some more, and then, but at the end, he's always encouraging people to continue and to use. I think this feeling is, use the examples that you've heard as examples that you are not far from the way. It's just a little adjustment you just need to make. You just keep adjusting, you know. Continue to sit upright when you slump.
He also frequently, Kazon, in the lectures, at some point comes around or makes it the main point of the lecture that don't worry about the difference between enlightenment and not enlightenment. It's just another trap. It's just another duality. As long as you're thinking in those terms, mm-hmm. You're stuck, but you can pivot where you are. So I think maybe the discussion about sudden and gradual enlightenment are also in that genre. It's kind of a trap to be trying to let yourself be divided, to let your mind be divided that way, instead of experiencing the unity of the present moment.
There's, I don't want to linger too much longer, but speaking of religion, there was a story that Alan Sinaki told me that they had this conference, and They had a conference about the ring that some people have in their rakusus, and there were apparently huge debates at some point in the religious history about the ring and whether the ring was appropriate and who should put the ring in and, you know, what color it should be and that sort of thing, you know. So, you know, as Oscar's saying, I mean, when we hear about that, we think, oh boy, you know, is that really what we should be focusing on? You know, should we really be parsing these distinctions, or is our practice just more right here, settle in, breathe this wonderful breath, and be present with our friends?
Now we should argue about stone.
Okay.